This is a talk on the continuation of the Eightfold Path in the year-long series that we've been doing on the Four Noble Truths. And this particular talk is on wise effort. And for those of you who are expert on the Eightfold Path, you'll perceive that I've taken the sixth step, which is wise effort, and placed it on the third rung. Which I can do. But you need an explanation for why I'm doing it. So I want to give you an explanation. The way the grouping of the Eightfold Path is usually depicted is that there are two links of proper orientation, which is wise view and wise intention. Those set the course of our path. They set the direction and they set the commitment or the resolution of heart and to follow that path. And then the next three links, wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood, are skillful action or sila, or the ethical relationship we have to that orientation. And then followed by the last three, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise samadhi. And those are the qualities of mind which are nourished and which really gain the momentum and hold the continuity for the whole path to unfold. So, but the way I'm teaching it in this series is a little bit different in the sense that I'm breaking up that a little. And I'm setting the course for us to embody our wisdom right off. So we have the first step was wise view, which is the perhaps misperceived fact that there is interconnectedness to life, that it isn't as disparate and distant and isolated as our eyes seem to betray it. And that once we take a firm resolution of heart to walk the path towards greater connection, then we have established the intention for ourselves to make this as our primary purpose in life, really. I mean, there are other side intentions, as I've spoken about in other talks, that sometimes take precedent or sometimes allure us off the path. But the deep, heartfelt need to come back together, to reconnect, to not disconnect, to not further isolate, but to regroup and to consolidate back in to oneself and to into all things is primary, or should be, or must be primary for our spiritual lives to unfold in the right way. But now the reason I insert effort here is that effort is kind of I mentioned last week, the analogy of sitting down in your car, you have your map, you know where you're going to be driving, you have the intention to drive there, you have every intention to drive there without getting waylaid in too many different spots and rest areas. But now, so you put the key in the ignition. As the ignition turns and the motor starts running, at that very moment, that is analogous to wise effort. It's the actual putting forth in action of body, speech, and mind what it is that we intend in the direction we intend to move. And so this is because the whole Eightfold Path has to do with the embodiment of ourselves, full embodiment in this wise view, with this wise view and with this deep intentionality, I have brought effort at this point into the cycle so that then as we begin to talk about where effort is allocated, where effort is distributed in body, speech, and mind, which will be the next aspect of the path. It'll make sense to us. So wise effort. Now, I want to just stop for a second because, and back up, transgress if I could. I keep framing these talks as wise view in accordance with interrelatedness or interconnectedness, or I've mentioned oneness. Someone mentioned to me that in some sutta, the Buddha was asked a series of questions, one of which says, well, can you say that we are all separate people? And he says, no, I can't say that. He says, well, can you say that we are all together? And he says, no, I can't say that. He says, well, can you say that we're one, of one nature, just oneness? And the Buddha said, no, I can't say that. And so this person's question to me was, how can I say that if the Buddha couldn't? Well, fair enough. Because you have to, I think if you understand skillful means and you understand that the truth cannot be conceived, to put any wordage onto the truth, to call it another word or an expression, is actually at some point misleading. And it's the self, the sense of self, loves the fact that it's moving towards oneness, or it has some goal in mind. And then when it gets there, there is actually a perception of interconnectedness that people will have, you will have, in the course of your practice, if you haven't already. It just feels as if there's a sensate feeling that of things being together. So, but is that the absolute fact? Well, no, the absolute fact can't be perceived or conceived. The absolute fact is what we are. What we are is an expression, is an ongoing expression of being. And being can't perceive itself. So you can't perceive yourself, right? You can't perceive the truth. And therefore, the Buddha said, any way that you conceive the truth is other than the way you conceive it. So he just lays it out in that way. Now, is there a skillful way that we can use the meditation and the journey of spiritual awakening to come to that level of being? Yes, there is. Because in that level of being, there is no sense of other than. Okay? There's no sense of someone else other than. There's no sense of two. The way I think that that's best held in the frame of the concept is to say interconnectedness or oneness. And so we use the tool of skillful means of oneness or interconnectedness to bring us more and more through the boundariness of self, through the multiple ways that we keep thinking of ourselves as being separate from. And that way we begin to burn out the very energy that the self creates to find an isolated and separate thing from the being that we are. Now that is why skillful means can be very helpful. Is it can help you move. Even conceptually, it's okay to use a concept to end concepts. And then at the end, even oneness has to be released. We even have to go beyond oneness, because that's just another conceptualization of reality. So the Buddha, in his wisdom, wouldn't get into these disputes about whether there was incarnation or not incarnation or oneness or many. He just wouldn't answer, or when he did, he would just say no to it. So we're saying yes to it, but cautiously. Okay. So wise effort. Now, effort is interesting because effort is a manifestation of our understanding and how awake we are, really. And the effort we make is a reflection of how we understand ourselves. And some of us make a half-hearted effort, because part of the understanding of who we think we are is somebody who isn't very adequate or sufficient. And so we don't believe that our effort, because of how we hold our sense of self, will ever lead to anything of any value. And so our effort can often be less than complete because of the way we think about ourselves in making that effort. This can also work against us spiritually. Sometimes we find methodologies, practices, that reinforced a strong sense of the, sort of the painful sense of me that we, the painful sense of me that says I'm not deserving of this. I'm not deserving of this, and therefore I have to go through a lot of pain, or I have to go through a lot of ambitious effort, I have to go through a lot of strenuous effort in order to overcome my disadvantaged feeling of self, and therefore I will then be worthy for the nobility of the path. And so we can put ourselves within the power and control of somebody who has us do all sorts of difficult and unskillful actions. Or we can put ourselves in methods and practices where the sense of the practice is that you have to get over yourself, almost an aesthetic practice where there's something wrong with you, and you can find teachers who encourage that viewpoint. Or we can get involved with very harsh methods of sitting for long duration, and where our knees just feel like they're dropping out because we feel as if we have to go through this almost torturous regimen in order to be worthy of our spiritual life. So I want to caution us that we carry, the effort that we carry is the effort of how we see ourselves. And often that is as unwise as any aspect of our behavior, especially if those tendencies are coming from an unconscious part of ourselves. Well, we don't even know that we're feeling so self-belittling, but the methods we use are so harsh that it becomes obvious that how we care about ourselves through that harsh method. Now, so saying, there is often a series of steps that people go through as their understanding deepens and as their effort changes in accordance with that deepening of their understanding. And it starts out almost universally with people only knowing the effort of their own power, of their own will, of their own influence. And so there can be a lot of sincerity in trying hard. There can be a lot of sincerity in trying to sit and going back to the breath. And I felt like in my early days, I had a lot of sincerity, but very little wisdom. And I just kept, I just had incredible tenaciousness, and I would have done anything. I would have, you know, been self-brutal because I didn't have, at that point, much of an self-acceptance. And so I did things which to this day I still have scar tissue from, psychic scar tissue from, where just as an example, I was in a group of very experienced meditators, and the man who was leading it was having us take vow hours, and we would sit 1 hour, and then if we felt we could do the next hour. Vow hour was an hour where you did not move. You made a vow that you would not move, not even a flick of your finger. And if you made it through the first hour, you can then take the second hour. And if you made it through the second hour, you can then take the third hour. Well, I was brand new to this kind of instruction. And after the first hour, I was hurting pretty bad, and nobody moved. And I wasn't about to move, be the only one that moved. And then, so I made it through the second hour, but I was sweating blood, and nobody moved. And so then I stayed for the third hour, and it was, to this day, probably the most excruciating hour of my life, to this point where when pain starts coming up in the areas in which they were in those hours, I flinch because I conditioned in me that level of adversity and that level of aversion. So what I'm saying, just to cut this all short, is that it's not helpful to be self-brutal here. But often we do start with that tendency of intense resolve, especially if we're sincere about it, because we don't know any other way to be sincere except through our own manual manipulation. But that doesn't work very long, or for very long, because we get tired of that. And we stretch out our arms to make that kind of strenuous effort, but our arms feel like lead after a while. We have to put our arms down to our side. And it's at that point we're ready to move into a different relationship to effort. And that different relationship then becomes one which changes to self-acceptance. We realize that we can't keep brutalizing this thing, that it has to be included in this meditation. We have to orient ourselves towards self-love. And even though that's maybe a very foreign relationship to ourselves, nevertheless, we see that it absolutely has to happen if this thing is going to work. And we start working with it. And we do many different techniques, perhaps, to orient ourselves to self-acceptance, metta being one of them. And just starting to take ourselves into our heart, to start acting through forgiveness and doing the things that are necessary so that there's a soft landing at the end of our rather violent way we perceive. And so that's a deepening of understanding, to start taking yourself into your heart. So you can see your effort moves in accordance with the understanding. But we're not finished yet. The next level of understanding comes in wanting, the next level of effort comes in wanting to understand the mind and body, to understand the connection, how it works. To know the difference, to want to know the difference between thinking about something and the actual abiding in that experience. And that's a very different orientation to effort than a striving, ambitious, goal-setting effort. Because now when we move to an effort to understand, we are moving to a form of interconnection. Because when we want to understand something, we want to, and in Thai, the word understanding means entering the heart, kaujai, entering the heart. We want to assimilate with it to a degree so that it does enter us, so that there is a connection with it. To learn about anything, to listen to anything, to receive anything, these words start having meaning for us. And with it, the tone of effort moves in accordance with those words. So we're no longer trying to set a goal that's outside of ourselves. We're now bringing the goal within ourselves, starting to assimilate life and understand our way through this process, which is an extraordinary change of reference. But I want to say again that these other forms of effort aren't bad. They're not wrong. They're just misunderstanding. We're just misunderstanding ourselves. It's not that you're doing something wrong if you find yourself being very ambitious, if you have just started your practice. But if you're 5 or 6 years into your practice and you're still doing that, then there's something we're not listening to in it. There's some way that ambitious effort, if it isn't leading to its own ending, to its own arrest, then we quite likely are not really opening to the self-loathing. We're trying to get over ourselves. Ourself is the problem, is the obstacle. And the goal setting is a way to get over ourselves, out of our bodies, out of our minds, and reaching ahead of ourselves so that we can become something other than what we fear we already are. So if we find ourselves in that kind of ambitious effort for too long, then we really need to move into the different equations of how we meet ourselves with intolerance. We need to bring that forth, because that's the beginning of that softening, the beginning of allowance, the beginning of openness, the beginning of receptivity, of interconnected effort, interconnection. Now, once we have been willing to discover the harmlessness of our mind, the harmlessness of our emotions, the harmlessness of fear, the harmlessness of fear, when we're willing to move into those more difficult areas with the right orientation, with effort, so that we begin to learn about them rather than to feel like they've betrayed us, to have a personal stake and a strong identity in everything that happens in our mind. When we have that impersonal quality to it, then we can move much more rapidly through this with a greater degree of softness and allowance that allows us to understand that much more quickly. Then we begin to ask very uncomfortable questions of ourselves. This is the next level of effort. Asking very uncomfortable questions, questions that a sane person would never ask. Questions like, what am I? What am I? Sane people don't ask, what am I? They assume they already know and then act in accordance to that assumption. But this form of effort ties in with something that is very important at this point. It ties in with our longing. Remember that intentionality follows the longing for completion, follows the longing for absolute contentment, or however we frame freedom in absolute terms. When that's coupled with effort, we are willing to ask the questions we never would ask otherwise. And the next expression of effort is to take us to the edge of the cliff time and time again so that we can look at the abyss in front of us. It gives plenty of freedom to pull back from that and say, oh, wait a minute, this is going too far, too fast for me. Too much fear, terror at that. Okay, let me pull back, which is fine. There's no rush. There's no time, said the poem that I read this evening. Just stop and stand still and ask the hard question from time to time. One of the hardest questions to ask is the question, is this true? When we start looking at the facts that we have believed our life to be, the foundation on which we are built and on which our purpose and intention is also built, when you ask questions at that level of your being, you are willing to pull the rug out from underneath everything that has meant something to you. And those questions are questions of self-love, not self-destruction. They are questions that come from the longing of connectedness. Because we realize that the most destructive thing we can do is to stay in a separate relationship to the world. And we are unwilling, and the effort ties into that, and it's unwilling to be satisfied any longer in that perspective with life. I am outside looking in perspective to life. Now the longing takes over, and the longing guides the effort. And when the longing guides the effort, the longing doesn't take us out of ourselves. It doesn't take us away from ourselves in search. Because in search means that the real view of life is that I need to gain access or entrance into freedom. And we are no longer willing to agree to that prescription of events. We know it's in us. We know it's in us. We might not perceive it, we might not feel it, but we intuit it. We intuit it. We sense it because our longing pulls us in that way. And so the longing is not a search for something outside of ourselves, but a deep yearning for the completion of ourself. And of ourself is with a capital S now, not with a small s. What is this thing when I am no longer isolating myself or distancing myself or selfing myself at every step and every turn? And then the yearning, the intentionality that follows that yearning, and the view of authentic living, which is the view of using life for what it's meant to do, is to come back into itself. Life meeting itself. Then the ongoing effort that is needed is this willingness to step out of self-deception time and time and time again. Asking those questions all along the way. Is this true? Is it true that I know what you're thinking of me? Because when I assume you do know what, when I do know what you're thinking of me, then we are cut off completely. There's a great schism between us, a cavern uncrossable. When I think anything about you, I have created an infinite distance between us. And it's only when I meet our relationship in the heart. And so my effort goes in asking those questions on an ongoing basis of every perceivable projection I could have of all things, of all you, based upon my pain, because projection is always based upon some unresolved issue in ourselves, which is why I have to put the issue onto you, which is what projection is, so that I can then avoid you and not avoid the issue in myself. So I have to look at that, because my heart's yearning, my effort, the effort to come back in, to make this union, to consummate this union, requires that every obstacle that seems to keep that gulf at hand needs to be questioned. And I don't care. I don't care what gulf it is. I don't care what it is. Is this true? Is this the fact of life? Is this the actual truth of life, the actual reality of life? And so now as this deepens, you see the deepening, the willingness to work in this way deepens the whole movement of heart. It creates a longing of immeasurable intensity. Immeasurable intensity. It's not a casual longing. It's a longing that follows us through every event in life, which is why we can then frame every event for us to be able to use it for the way that events can be, to come back together. We know what wise view is then, because we begin to feel it in the cells of our body. See, wise view says that we are inherently together. Okay? Now, if we are inherently together, what effort are we going to make in our spiritual practice? What do you want to overcome? So if all things are together inherently, and I'm just using this, please, as a skillful means, not as the absolute truth, I call it the four R's. Relax, rejoin, relinquish, and release. That's our effort. The effort starts with relaxation. Okay, my anxiety and my fear is about something happening to me, some outside event, some tragedy. And so I am defending myself against the inevitability my mind says is going to happen. What's the counterpose for anxiety, for tension, for resistance? Relaxation. So my effort doesn't go to do something about the fear. It goes towards relaxing the separation that the fear says is inherently there. Because the fear has its own message. Its message is one, is it true that I am separate from this thing? I'm about to be destroyed, or whatever our fear might be. Is this true? If it's not true, then I release the tension. I don't need to defend myself. Does that mean then that we fall prey to unskillful action because we just like show our jugular vein to whomever wants to take a bite? No. No. Because I know where your mind will go to a way out. You see, it'll create what I call the Hitler factor, where you'll find some objectable reason that you can't do what I'm pointing. And you'll say, well, I'm not doing that because Hitler might be on the other end of it. It's that factor, wherever that factor might be, which will pull us out of grace. Okay? But what comes in relationship to relaxation is clarity. You see more. You discern more. You discriminate. You see it. And you don't want to hurt yourself any more than you want to hurt anyone else, so you get out of the way. You don't drive down to the city parts of town and hang out with bulging billfolds. Or something. So relax. Effort towards relaxation. An effort towards relaxation. So you deserve to be relaxed? Do you deserve to be relaxed? I think you do. I think I do. If you don't, then use your effort to come to a degree of self-acceptability where you feel deserving to offer yourself the greatest gifts that you can, because this journey will offer you the greatest gifts. And if you don't feel like you're deserving of them, you've got more work to do on the acceptance level, because they will come. And we each need to be able to own them as a part of ourself, as a natural next step. Rejoin. The effort to rejoin. You know, when your emotions feel so disparate and so contentious and so anxiety provoking and so isolating and cutting us off, there's something going on that's not right. I mean, those feelings should really be questioned, because they're not right. They're just not, they don't fit anything. They don't fit our longing, they don't fit any intuitive sense of what life is. They just fit our empowerment and our control and our willful righteousness, but they don't fit anything meaningful. So let's rejoin. Let's say, okay, let me have the willingness to rejoin at this point and not just go along with my anger, my fear, my impatience, my whatever, but to rejoin it. First, we don't ask some destructive maneuver on the emotion. We ask to rejoin it. So we rejoin the emotion. Interconnection starts with connecting in what is happening in us, intrapsychically. And then from then, we then own the symptoms of all the things that we have projected out from that emotion. We then own all of that. We then own all of the ways that we have betrayed life through our thinking, which the emotion is very ready and willing to do. It's that rejoining, the effort to rejoin. You see, I'm not asking anything brutal, just the opposite. The effort to relinquish. To relinquish the boundaries. Now, I say this knowing that some of you need to shore up your boundaries, because intrapsychically, if you have given yourself away and never really owned yourself in fulfillment, then you need to structure your life and your psychology and your acceptance so that you do have a strong sense of self-acceptance and not giving yourself away. But at some point, boundaries become intolerable to the heart, because boundaries are a form of resistance and contention with life, a form of defensiveness, a form of brutality to life. And to start looking and relinquishing boundaries sense of separation. Wherever I draw a line that puts a boundary between myself and whatever else, the skin boundary, the mind boundary, where it's cut off from the rest of the body, the body's boundary, awareness's boundary. See, we start working it. We start working it. We start working it on all the fronts. And release. 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 Willingness to release our separation. Willingness to release our separation. Wherever we find ourselves separate, the willingness to release it. Because it's all it is resistance. So you just, we start looking for areas in ourself that we're resisting. And so our meditation becomes, which brings us all the way back to relaxation, because the more you release, the more you relinquish, the more you rejoin, the deeper relaxed you are. The deeper relaxed you are, the less boundaries are formed. The less boundaries are formed, the more you join. The more you join, the more you relinquish. See, it's really only saying one word. Come together. Because this is the intentionality of our practice. And unless our efforts meet this intentionality full-heartedly, then we will be in splinter, we'll be splintered. We have to be very on top of unwise effort. We have to be very shrewd here, because we would love to use the assumptions of our separation to come to unity. We would love to strive. We would love to set goals for ourselves. The fact that I need something, you know, we all feel we need something. But is that feeling real? Is it true? And can we come beneath the surface of that neediness to be able to hold completely in totality and wholeness that feeling? If we can hold that feeling of me being incomplete completely, completely, you'll find that it does not send us in search of completion. It will be the very statement of completion, even though its message seems to indicate a difference, a contrast. See, this unwise effort in our spiritual growth, we have to be very careful in our spiritual growth, because our spiritual growth, we would love to claim personal responsibility for our personal growth. We would love to claim credit for how much our spirit, we've grown spiritually. That we would make our spiritual growth a personal affair. It's our personal affair. We love that. Then we can be special in it. Somebody else doesn't have their personal affair and not doing it, well, then they're sort of judged. But I don't judge, right? So it's the judging my trying to be not judging, basically. Which is all the effort to surmount the obstacle of myself. We need to keep hearing that. This is not about surmounting the obstacle of ourselves. It's about joining ourselves. It's about, there's nothing wrong here. Depending upon how you see that there is, that's where your efforts need to go towards self-acceptance. Insert the right effort at the right understanding. Just know when to use the right card. Play the right card. So that if you're trying to get over yourself, not enough allowance, not enough acceptance, not enough love, self-love. Okay, let me do the things that are necessary to bring that depth of understanding there so that I can move into the next phase of my effort. Some helpful points about effort. First, We must feel the urgency to put forth the effort. And the greatest impediment to feeling that urgency is our doubt. When we feel the doubt, go to the doubt. Don't let the doubt play out its scene. Don't let it take us to a distorted view of the path. Keep in mind wise view and connect with the doubt. Nothing is meant to react from. Everything is meant to connect with. Even the doubt, that which is most destructive, that which keeps us most distant. Now what are we going to do? The mind can't do anything to us that we don't connect with. You see, that's it. The game's over at that point. Wherever it turns me, I turn to it. Wherever it distances me, I close the gap by allowing it to come in, by opening my heart to it. This is all about the heart. I hope you hear that. Sometimes reflecting on death can create that urgency, can get us feeling not stressed or anxious that we're going to die, we better get it together, but feeling the preciousness of this moment. And when we feel the preciousness of this moment, we'll start feeling the yearning from that preciousness. Because when we connect with the moment and its precious quality, then the yearning for more, the yearning for fullness in that appreciation, in that beauty, the yearning to deepen our connection to that is there. Second point, we have to have interest in to understand the problem. We have to be interested in understanding the problem. We have to awake to the suffering we cause ourselves and to others. If we awake to the suffering we cause ourselves and others, we will become interested in the problem. Because none of us have bad hearts in this room. None of us want to intentionally inflict pain on others, and hopefully we're learning the same about ourselves. But when you see that the way you orient your life to the world creates suffering just through that orientation, then you'll get very interested in how to change that view to the proper and wise view. Third, it takes courage to connect with a problem and see it for ourselves. So interest and courage. We have to rediscover the Four Noble Truths. Every one of us here have to rediscover the Four Noble Truths. It's written in a million different texts through a million different years of scriptural editing, and it doesn't do a thing for us to have it on the page. Each one of us have to have the courage to walk this thing through our personal experience, seeing and allowing the Four Noble Truths to unfold right in front of our eyes, so that we are with, there is no doubt what this life is about. And then, the fourth, and perhaps the most difficult, is to live on an ongoing basis that truth. Honesty to follow what we know and now have learned to be true, and not slip back into the patterns of self-destructibility, of self-formation. And that, for most of us, takes enormous patience. The Buddha said, patience is the highest form of devotion. Because you are saying, by opening one's arms and saying, okay, I made another mistake, and being honest and looking at that, learning from it, And just knowing that it is not within your power, not within your power to move you one inch, forward or backward, that the only thing that any of us have is the awareness and honesty and sincerity to see. And so we are completely powerless here. At this point, our effort of any striving, of any self muscling is gone. We turn our life over to the grace of observation. And we can't even claim that to be ours, because we see it's not. It's much bigger than we are. And it's everlasting, and we're finite. And therefore, what are we going to do? What are we going to do except sit still and relax, rejoin, relinquish, and something else?
Release.
Release. Thank you all very much. Can we sit for a minute or two? As you're sitting, I want to read something from the Sutta Nipata, which is one of the older texts of the Buddhist tradition. And now that I've gone through the whole range of effort, please listen to this as the farthest range, the deepest view of what effort is. The Buddha says, "And so, perfected in understanding, the wise dissipates all clinging. They have seen how the forces of becoming can be stopped, so they do not go forward towards more births, towards more becoming. There is another way of describing this insight. One insight is that effort is the basis of all suffering. The other insight is that by the complete cooling and cessation of effort, no more suffering is produced. These are the two insights. Grasp them together, and with energy, dedication, and care, you can expect this result. Every form of suffering grows out of effort. Eradicate effort, and no more suffering is produced. Consider this harmful consequence of effort, that it is the basis of suffering. But when all effort has been abandoned, there is freedom of the effortlessness." Okay, so if there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to respond if I can. Yes.
So, as you were talking, I thought of an experience that happened, I think, last winter probably, and it seems connected, and I just have to say it, and it seems
please,
like you can say
please.
And it has to do with, I think, relaxation and the body.
Yes.
So I was in a sauna.
Yes.
And I was going back and forth between the really hot sauna and cold.
Yes.
And my body was like wet rag after that.
Yes.
I was lying down.
Yes.
And it was really helpful, so I was...
Yes. No, I would say the sauna in this case brought forth enormous clarity. And perhaps
it was clarity.
It didn't melt you away. When you began to perceive that the thoughts that usually hook us so deeply and disturbingly, there can be this enormous contentment and seeing, and not in the connecting with them, but the complete impersonalization of what they're saying. And so this deep contentment, see, we don't realize that the offsetting qualitative shift that happens when we don't personalize is this deep abiding contentment. We think non-personalization sounds cold and drab and isolating and even worse than the fear response, which we can at least tolerate and are familiar with, because we don't understand that the whole world comes in. Everything we've ever wanted comes in its absence, you see. And so for a moment when you catch that, when you get that, Don't think, though, that it was the sauna that produced it. Then we'll try to go out and remanufacture the conditions, right? That is a moment of clarity. You're seeing life, you're seeing yourself, you're seeing what normally you react to in a completely different way in that moment. Probably through your relaxed response, relaxation. There was no tension, no resistance, right? So those are very helpful insights to have. Yes? The first what?
The first R.
Yes.
The relaxing.
Yes.
And whether or not it's true, if I'm being exact. And I don't want to do the Hitler thing, but I want to know what is the alternative. Like, if you are being attacked, what is, how...
If you are being...
Attacked.
Yes.
I'm not saying physically, but let's say...
Right.
Emotionally or whatever.
Yeah. How do you relax when you're being emotionally attacked? You have to find your way through that answer. You're looking for a blueprint for safety. And what I would encourage you to do is to see what it is that you're trying to protect from that attack. Is there some truth to what they're saying, and which is the reason you have to feel defensive in regards to it? Because if you're not feeling the truth of what's being said, then the attack never comes, even though the conversation might happen. The attack is your only contingent upon your defenses. And if you're not defending yourself, that is, you have no reason to, or if you're willing to learn from what's being said so that you're interested in what the person is saying as an additional pointing so that you can heal to a problem that might be in you, then the attack, even though the tone might be of an attack, it's actually information that can be very helpful. You see? So attack is only because there's something we feel we need to protect. Go to where it is that you feel you need to protect it. Unless it's a physical attack, which you try to get out of the way of as quickly as possible, right? Or if it's emotional abuse where you're in some kind of strange relationship where those kinds of things, I'm not suggesting that you stay in that, but in the normal way that people can say negating or unkind things to you throughout the day, just in the matter of exchanging or comments or whatever, those are the ones that I'm suggesting here, that we move to look and see whether what it is, where the hook was in us, and to examine that hook, what we need, what we aren't getting, what our expectation is, what our image is, and how our image is being met in that moment. Okay? Yes?
Well, first, thank you so much for the teaching tonight. It's been real helpful. I've been looking a lot lately at my connection to loneliness.
Yes, good one. Loneliness.
And it seems very much like a slippery animal.
Yes.
When I give it attention and open the heart, it very quickly disappears.
Yes.
And
yes.
And yet it finds itself quickly crawled right back.
Yes.
Yes,
it does.
It seems as if I've had a connection to it since I was very little.
Yes. Yes, most of us have. And I really appreciate the question because most of us suffer from loneliness. And... it's interesting, and I don't mean in any way to put myself, I never feel lonely anymore. And it's because at some level of wakefulness, the sense of orienting yourself to life where there is an emotional lacking, it just doesn't come. With a certain degree of wakefulness. And you're experiencing that degree of wakefulness periodically. When you go to your heart, when you don't resist loneliness, when you just say, okay, let me see. Let me just let it sit here. If your willingness to ingest it, it doesn't hold the story of the tragedy of your life. The story of the tragedy of your life is what keeps confiscating your resistance to the sense of loneliness. The sense of loneliness, when it is felt, is just an emotion It's the storyline that has the real hard truth to it. And it just starts becoming quite silly, because alone from what? When we are in presence, when we are present, when we are attentive, what aren't we? I can't imagine what we're not connected to. That doesn't even come up. It doesn't even, the frame of reference doesn't even come up. And you're experiencing moments of that. As you allow yourself to feel it more and more fully, without embellishing the story, there'll come a moment, a threshold moment, in which it won't be convincing, even when the story is there. Just as Lynn was saying. And when you see that threshold, the water, the tide has changed. And when the tide changes as such, you may have moments in which there's this brief feeling of something that you used to call loneliness. But it doesn't catch, it's just like that. It's just like a wind that just passed through. You go, what was that? I don't know. And it won't stick. So this intermediate time, when it's sticking and then not sticking and sticking and not sticking, that can be very difficult. But give it more of the same. Give it more attention, more relaxation, let it come on. And don't keep embellishing the story that keeps the loneliness true. Question the story. Is this story really true? Look at the storyline. Write it down. It's so obvious that it's not true as soon as it's penciled to paper. Okay? Right? When it's up here, it's like, yeah. Because you... Good. Okay. Yes, last question.
I just wanted to ask a question on the last part you said about effort. So if all effort, is consequently like wrong because it's struggling.
Right. Yes. What I'm talking about, what the Buddha was, I think, talking about, okay, in that final thing. You see, when I'm talking about relaxing, releasing, relinquishing,
releasing.
In releasing. if you look at that, if you see, let's just take relaxing. When your fist is tight, that's the effort. Is relaxing effort? Relaxing is the relinquishment of effort. It's the relinquishment of will. It's the relinquishment of force, isn't it? So when you start seeing that the relinquishment is what brings things together, the force and tightness is what separates things out, then the effort of tightening, which is the effort of will, that effort of ambition, of striving to get over yourself, that just causes more pain. And is not in service to your spiritual life. Practice it the other way. Okay. Now, so saying, and this will be my talk a week after next, because it's the second talk on wise effort. There are cultivated qualities of the mind, which the Buddha talked about in the last two steps, samadhi and mindfulness, which do require you to keep coming back to your breath and doing that sort of thing, you see, to strengthen those qualities which will lead to a deepening understanding of seeing so that you can give up the need to have to do that. It seems paradoxical. It is paradoxical. But it's also true. Okay. Good luck to you all.